Thank you. I first want to take the opportunity, since I'm the last speaker, to thank Anna and her team for organizing this wonderful conference. Thank you. Such a pleasure to be here. Now, another side of being the last speaker is I was thinking about either giving you like a 20-page handout, because my paper, in a sense, like, refers to so many passages, but then I thought you will have seen all these passages by now, and I'm sure you just memorized all of it during the earlier talks. So you have a handout, but one that is comparatively speaking more minimal than it could have been. Now, my topic today is how the Stoics thought of the problem that is best known as the problem of free will and determinism. And what I want to do is basically just get clear about the question. Like, what is for them the problem? What is for them the question? Rather than put forward any answers. I mean, I will say a little bit about the answers that I think are, you know, have a shot at being good Stoic answers, but that is not my focus. My focus is trying to find a formulation of what is for the Stoics the kind of problem that later on becomes the problem of free will and determinism. Now, I take it that there is, in a sense, an easy, sort of easy solution for the Stoics to that problem, and that easy solution is to say that the reasoning faculties of human agents are portions of the world's reason. And insofar as that is the case, we as reasoners are genuine agents. Case closed. So we are agents. So qua our reasoning faculties being portions of the world's reason, we are genuinely the agents, the causes of our own actions. And that's fine. Now, at the same time, I take it that there has to be a problem. So it can't be the case that this is just all we need to say, and then we see that the Stoics actually don't have a problem, because they address what is their version of the freedom determinism problem in a lot of areas of their philosophy. So they must think that they have a problem. And if we reconstruct their philosophy such that the problem disappears, then we've done something wrong. So they address that type of problem in any number of areas. One is, you know, talking about fate. One is talking about the causal role of impressions versus the causal role of assent. One is what in Aristotelian discussions is called the problem of contingentia futura, future contingents. So do assertions about future, what happens, say, tomorrow, do they have a truth value or not? That's another big topic in Stoic philosophy, and so on and so forth. So given that there are all these discussions, they must think they have a problem. Hence, like, a way of looking at it which makes it look as if the problem that isn't even a hard problem for them can't be right either. So further, it seems like, at least in some ways, consensual among scholars that whatever their problem is, it's not well described as the problem of free will and determinism. Certainly not free will, because as at least a lot of people think, there's no such thing as the will in Stoic philosophy. Freedom, you know, another big question, what that would be. But even the term determinism is possibly not quite right. Why not? You know, that depends, of course, on how you use the term. But the way we think about, or we tend to think about determinism in, you know, either today or modern philosophy, early modern philosophy, is fairly closely tied to a conception of science as physics. And you may think that that is getting the Stoics in some sort of fairly basic way wrong, because their science is, in a sense, a biology of the cosmos as a large living being that has its biography, and they mean it. So this is not just a metaphor. It really is the claim that the world is a large living being, and it has a biography, and the study of nature is the study of that. There are no fundamental laws of physics, and so on and so forth. So the sorts of things that you go to if you spell out what you mean when you talk about determinism, that say the fundamental laws of physics regulate the goings-on in nature or whatever, those sorts of things are just not going to fit into Stoic philosophy. And hence, of course, you can use determinism in another sense. That's fine. But the way we usually think about it is not going to work. So with both of the core notions of like either free will or freedom on the one hand and determinism on the other hand, it's sort of not clear that either of them is at all a good fit for what we are talking about in Stoic philosophy. And hence, you know, hence my task here of reformulating what might be a better fit. Now, another sort of brief word on just situating where this comes from or what some of my inspirations are. On the handout, I actually have like a quick footnote just referring to some of the work that I'm engaging with. I'm not going to actually refer to these philosophers as I go along, just to acknowledge my debt to it. But one thing I want to say, in a sense, my paper is a kind of response paper to a paper in contemporary metaphysics by Jonathan Schaffer. That paper is called The Action of the Whole. My paper is called The Agency of the World. And I want my title to sort of signal that, in a sense, I'm responding to what he's doing. And why? Because I think the intuition that he tries to explain is one that is really close to the Stoic picture. His proposal is that the agency of the whole is prior to the agency of its parts. And he calls that a kind of monism. And something like that is bound to be true for the Stoics, that the agency of the world, with God or reason as agent, active principle, is in some sense the agency of the whole, and what we do is what some of the parts of the whole do. So one idea that I just want to try out here, and it's very much sort of a hypothetical thing, is whether describing what we think of as the problem of freedom and determinism in terms of either a part-whole problem or a one-many problem, whether that is helpful. So the way I put the problem on the handout at the beginning is to say that the Stoics seem committed to two claims that don't evidently fit together. And one is that God is the agent, the one agent, the cause of everything. And the other claim is that there are many agents or many causes, namely all those components of the world, including human beings, that are agents of some sort and that are causes. And if that is a way to think about the problem that is later called the problem of free will and determinism, then the task is to explain how that fits together, how the one agent is such that it accommodates the many agents. That would be the task. And that is my proposal, that's how one should try to reconstruct the Stoic, how the Stoics conceive of the problem. Now, before I begin to sort of go through it in a like step-by-step way, another disclaimer. I think that the kinds of things that Ricardo was talking about, eternal recurrence and so on, are a huge hurdle for making sense of the Stoic view. Why? Of the Stoic view on how we are agents, even though there is fate, or even though there's one cause for everything and so on. And why? Because you might think that, you know, if you think of yourself, say, having a cup of coffee now or having a cup of tea now. I happen to have both because I took tea thinking it was coffee. So now I have both. Now I can ask myself, will I have a cup of coffee or will I drink a sip from my cup of coffee? Will I have a sip from my cup of tea? You may think, you know, I could, rather than try and deliberate about that, or rather than try and make a decision, I could sort of try and make a prediction, because surely that happened in the previous world cycles. But prediction, that's a kind of slogan in action theory. Prediction crowds out deliberation. If you're in the business of predicting what you will do, you are not deliberating about what you will do. Those are really deeply different modes of thought. And for that reason, I think the eternal recurrence doctrine is a horrible hurdle for making sense of agency. Because if it is true, how can agents do anything other than try and predict what they will do? But that is not agency. So I want to set that to some extent aside, because those issues about time, in a way, are an uphill battle, I think, for every theory of that type, including today. So if today in the theory of action one took seriously everything that physics says about time, one would first, you know, backwards causation and so on and so forth, that would pose similar problems. And we don't stop doing action theory for that reason, I mean, because of these problems today. So I just want to flag that whatever we say about time in physics is going to be, either way, a big problem for action theory. But I think that we shouldn't just dismiss the Stoics on those grounds, because then we could dismiss a lot of attempts in action theory on those grounds, because physics tends to say things about time that are not easily squared with agency. So that's just an aside. Okay, now moving to section 2 on my handout. And given that a lot of things have been already discussed at this conference, I will run through some of it quickly. Now, just to remind everyone of what is the basic picture. The basic picture is there are two principles, that is, the word for principle is arche, two principles. One, the active principle, also called God, reason, has a few other names, and the passive principle, matter. Both are everlasting, ungenerated, and indestructible. They are corporeals. They are three-dimensional. They offer resistance. Matter, the passive principle, is entirely unqualified, but at every given point in time, inseparably connected to some quality or other. So matter is, you know, like a kind of intuitive way of putting this is you never encounter matter just in its unqualified condition. It is always qualified. It is qualified through the active principle which pervades matter. And that is how bodies are individuated and how they are qualified. Matter is divisible, but it does not by itself divide up into parts. It is because matter is subject to various ways of being qualified by the active principle that there are compounds. I'm going to use that word, compound. Compounds are elements first, the four elements. Then the soul in the sense of fiery breath, and then ordinary objects like stones, trees, animals, human beings, and finally, the world as a whole is also a compound. So that is sort of the basic picture. Now, one could say a lot about all of it, and I'm not going to do that, but I want to just say a few things, because the more I thought about it, the more doubtful it became to me that there is such a thing as a Stoic theory of causality. Why? Now, it's a kind of commonplace for people in ancient philosophy to say, well, there is a range of Greek terms which have a range of meanings, each of them. One of these meanings is cause, say, arche, aitia, so on and so forth. And sometimes you want to translate them as cause. But that fact of how difficult it is to map our concept cause on any of these concepts isn't always fully explored in action theory, I think. I think there's more, people say more about it in other fields of philosophy than they say about it in action theory. And I think that is really worth like taking seriously. So first, the principles are archai. So they are starting points, you know, however you want to put that, whatever you think archai is in that context, really difficult question, I think. So I'm leaving that open. I just want to flag that archai here is not translated as cause. Even though one of the archai, namely the act of principle, is a cause. But being a principle is not sufficient for being a cause, because the passive principle is not a cause. So the passive principle is an arche, but it's not a cause. And that's just worth taking in. Now, active principle is the standard translation. The Greek is topoion. And I'm sticking with the standard translation, active principle, but, you know, if you just sort of dwell on the notion topoion a little bit, you may think, well, maybe I could also translate it differently. I could say the making principle, or I could say the qualifier. Just sort of sticking with topoion and thinking about what that means. Now, we don't want to say the making principle, because that could lead to misunderstandings. It could lead to the misunderstanding that the active principle makes the passive principle. And that is like distinctively not the case. So it would be a misleading way of putting things. Nevertheless, topoion is, you know, active principle is also a compromise. It's a better compromise than saying the making principle. The active principle is what qualifies matter. And in that sense, the sort of really very literal sense of thinking about poion, or the connection between in the Greek text, if you read it in Greek, you have a sense of the closeness between topoion and poion. So topoion, the active principle, makes things poion. And so you might think it is like the qualifying principle. Another way to put it is that it is self-moving and moves everything else. That is a further just way of spelling out what the active principle is. It is self-moving and it moves everything else. So that is just, you know, a little bit thinking about what are we even talking about when we talk about the active principle and when we talk about these principles. Now, notably, we haven't really talked about causes yet. And the text that several of the other speakers discussed about a corporeal acting on another corporeal and the effect being a predicate, that is, in a way, the classic passage on, you know, what do the Stoics say about causality? Well, they say a corporeal acts on another corporeal and the effect is a predicate, and causes our bodies and causes our causes to each other, and they are causes of something incorporeal, and that incorporeal is the effect, and that's a predicate. And the standard examples are like the knife is cutting the paper, so the knife is a cause to the paper, and cut, being cut is the predicate, that's the effect, that's a predicate, that's incorporeal. So that's the passage that usually people refer to when they say, well, what do the Stoics say about causation? And now you can wonder, like, how is there a unified theory of causation which brings together what they say about the active principle as cause and about causation in this cause-to-cause effect sense? Because it's not clear that the active principle is a cause in that second sense. In none of the texts that talk about, that give you examples about causation in that sense, a corporeal is a cause to another corporeal, or cause to another cause, and the effect is a predicate. None of these texts mentions anything other than ordinary objects as examples. So knife, and paper, and persons, teacher, pupil, that was the example that Jean-Baptiste was referring to. So that's interesting. And it's just, you know, it's just something first to observe, that the active principle is not a cause to another cause. It must be a cause in a different sense. Now, the reason I think why that is not always observed in the literature, or why people don't sort of remark upon that, is that often our access to these ideas is via the Latin authors, Seneca and Cicero. They will use causa for all of it. So Seneca is going to say, you know, God, the active principle, is the causa, the primary causa, the only causa, and so on and so forth, the causa causarum. And then, you know, in that expression, causa causarum, you sort of hear how it works in the Latin text, that you have like the causarum, the many causes, that is what the causa is the cause of. But the causa God isn't one of the of these many causes. So that's, I think that is sort of roughly getting it right. This expression causa causarum, I think, is helpful. It's only not helpful in the sense that it doesn't make clear that these are in Greek two notions. It's not clear. It makes it seem a little bit like a unified theory of causality, and it's not even clear to me that the Stoics have a unified theory of causality. Now, then let's look at the compounds and how they move. The Stoic scala naturae, the Stoic like scale of nature, the Stoic account of what kinds of natural entities there are, interestingly proceeds via the way things move. So that's one major component of what we might call their theory of causation, and what they maybe don't call their theory of causation, to look at how do these compounds move. The lowest kind of natural entity that is being mentioned, things like stones and logs, can only be moved from the outside. Now, they are still part of the causal story because someone can take them and move them and, you know, hit someone else over the head or whatever with the stone. So they are part of the causal story, but they can only be moved from the outside. Plants move with the movement of growth by themselves. Animals, or out of themselves, animals move by themselves through fantasia. And then there's movement by reason, and that is how human agents move. Now, I'm not going to go through this passage. It's a very famous and well-known text. The important thing for us is to see that, like, the the scale and how these natural entities are being differentiated works on the one hand, but works by how they move, and that is in turn explained by the way in which they are pervaded by reason or the active principle or God, and how that individuates them. So the lowest kinds of natural entities are like held together or pervaded by and individuated by God or the active principle, in such a sense that they have hexes, which is often translated as tension, or you know, some presence of the active principle, which makes this stone a stone and keeps it together, as if we're plants have natures, animals have souls, and we have reason or rational souls. And that is how these compounds move. Now, next step of the picture, that is section 5 on my handout, just to make sure that we don't lose sight of this, the story about the active principle causing or making all these compounds and thereby moving the world as a whole is intended both as synchronic and diachronic. And that's important. So it's not as if, as it were, first the active principle makes these compounds and then they go and do their own actions. But that is intended as contemporaneous. So that's intended as synchronic. The active principle makes and moves all compounds, all parts of the whole. And at the same time, these compounds move in the ways in which they move. So that's how it's intended. In these parts of the world and their activities thereby co-cause all the activity there is in the world. So, right, that's the picture. And nevertheless, there's also a diachronic aspect to that proposal, in the sense that, as I said earlier, the world has a biography. And there's, as it were, like a beginning and an end of the action of the whole, of the agency of the world, of how the world as a whole moves and changes. That is, as it were, the biography of the cosmos, and that is also said to be caused by the active principle, and that is often expressed in terms of fate. That, like, all everything that becomes is fated, and so on and so forth. Okay, so this gives us, as it were, the building blocks of just the outlines of the proposal. And now I'm getting to what I said is the easy solution to the Stoic version of the problem of free will and determinism. The easy solution is just to say, and that is a proposal that John Cooper makes in just like one footnote in a paper on Stoic autonomy. He doesn't spell it out at all. And you know, years ago when I, for the first time, tried to make up my mind on what I think about this, I thought, well, that's like the one sentence of this huge body of literature that is making sense to me. Namely, the answer just really is that we are parts. So, and that our reasoning faculties are portions of the world's reason. And in that sense, what we do. So when you make a decision, or when you give assent to a hermetic impression, to an impression that such and such is to be done, katekon, that, you know, the tea is to be whatever. Then you drink the tea. And that's your mind assenting to the impression such and such is to be done. And this assent, and you know, there's, as we saw yesterday, there's a lot to be said about what really the action is, and Susan was talking about that, but at least the basic proposal is that when you assent to this kind of hermetic impression, which gives you which has a sort of to be done form, a cathecon form, then that sets off the action and the bodily movement. And it just seems that if your mind by which you ascend to this impression is a portion of the world's reason, then we just don't have a problem. Then we don't have the problem that the problem of free will and determinism is usually thought to be, because it's not as if something else makes you do this. It's not as if here's your mind plus there's like the laws of physics, or plus there's God, or plus there's some other causal story, but the causal story that is to be told about God and about the active principle is the story that your mind is a portion of it. So when you ascend, that's part of the world's activity, that's part of the world's reasons activities. And so you might think that's just the solution. That is all you need to say as a Stoic. Now, I want to close by just summing up what I think this means, and by going through a couple of objections and my replies on behalf of the Stoics. What this means, I think, is that the formulation, the Stoic, or the way one should reconstruct what for the Stoics is the version, their version of the problem of freedom and determinism, is a problem about how the one agent, the one cause, accommodates many causes, with us as human reasoners as some of these many causes. So then what you need to spell out if you're a Stoic is that one-many relationship, or you need to say something about, like, on even more abstract metaphysical level, you will need to say something about the relevant part-whole relationship. And that's some of what the Stoics do when they talk about the cosmos as a whole, with literally us as parts. I mean, that is an aspect of Stoic philosophy that I think is somewhat underrated, because it's so unpalatable. I mean, who wants to think of human beings? I mean, if you want to strengthen Stoic ethics as a sort of an interesting proposal in ethics, you may think you're not going to advertise the idea of us as parts rather than, you know, individuals or self-standing persons or something like that. And of course the Stoics don't mean it that way. So you know, people like us who like them, we will have a lot to say about it, because these parts of course are individuated. So they do have something to say about how a human being is individuated as a human being. And that's anyway, but that would be a huge chunk, I think, of what needs to be spelled out. That part-whole relationship, or in other terms, one-many relationship. I think that is sort of where the focus of the explanatory work has to go. And that's my proposal about how I think the Stoic version of the freedom determinism problem poses itself. Now, first objection, where's the law? You may think when you talk about freedom and determinism, you have to talk about the law. That's true, but I'm saying that's just another name for God, the active principle, reason, and so on. That's in Stoic philosophy, and that's one of the hardest things to get clear about, because in this whole topic, one of the real difficulties is to become aware of our of what we presuppose as just, well, that just has to be understood in such and such a way. And with the notion of the law, that is particularly difficult because we just think of laws of physics in a certain way as regulating causal relations or as regulating goings on in nature or something of that sort. And there just isn't that notion of law in Stoic philosophy. And that's difficult to fully appreciate, partly because some of the later sources already have sort of traces of the more modern conception of the law. And so some of what you will find in the text will sort of make you think that it's confusing, or either that it's sort of it's neither nor, it's not quite how the Stoics, the early Greek Stoics, will talk of, like, God is the law, somewhat closer to laws in the plural that regulate physical goings on. But that is just not, I think, a notion of the law that comes up in early Stoic philosophy. Second objection. Now, the traditional or the better known versions of the problem of free will and determinism have importantly a philosophy of mind side to them, in the sense that you can say, well, one way of describing the problem is, how does mental causation work? You know, there's closed chains, closed physical chains, and how does an agent thinking, I'm going to do such and such, how does that kind of mental causation insert itself into presumably closed chains of causation? That's one way of, you know, of describing the modern, kind of straw man version of the modern problem of freedom and determinism. And you may think that what the Stoics do is avoid that problem by sort of going all out for the most extreme position and saying all causing is mental. Because really everything that moves the world is someone's reasoning. It's the reasoning of God, or like the world's reasoning activities, or it's human reasoning, and that's it. So that it's as if it was, as if all causation was mental causation. And isn't that, you know, even worse? Because if mental causation is hard to understand, then if someone says that all causation is mental, maybe that's, you know, maybe that's not the way to go. But the Stoic comeback, of course, is that this notion of mental is just misguided, because Stoic sort of most basic assumptions about what reason is corporeal. So there's nothing mental in the sense of immaterial or anything like this involved here. And it is true for the Stoics that all causing is, in a sense, a kind of reasoning. It's the world's reason in its various sort of ways in which it is, in which it pervades compounds. But that is not well described with the term mental as it is used in later philosophy, because that is corporeal. Now, third objection, eternal recurrence makes agency pointless. Here I have to say maybe yes. So I'll just say that's a problem. And ultimately, part of what you need to do in figuring that out as a Stoic is also say how it relates to time, how it relates to your account of time. And that's not going to be easy. But anyway, that's the third objection. The fourth objection is, and that sort of returns to how I started, and I'll just say two more sentences about this. It wouldn't be plausible to offer a reconstruction of the Stoic version of the problem of free will and determinism that basically said that the problem disappears. That wouldn't be plausible. Why? Because the Stoics talk about it all the time, and they must think that there is a hard problem here. Otherwise, it wouldn't come up in logic, in moral philosophy, everywhere. So that could be an objection to my proposal that it comes close to making the problem disappear. And I want to say in response to that, well, it doesn't, because part of what you need to explain when you spell out how the reasoning of human agents relates to the world's reason, part of what you need to explain when you explain that is how it is that our reasoning faculties are literally assumed to be portions of the world's reason, but subject to norms, which is not the case for the world's reason. So our reasoning is subject to epistemic norms such as don't assent rashly, don't blah, blah, blah. So all these norms of assent, which are at the heart of Stoic philosophy, they have to fit into the account of human reasoning, but they don't apply to the reason of the world, which is a perfect reasoner. So the world is a perfect reasoner. So that is, of course, a normative notion, so it's not as if that is bare of normativity, but the point is that the world is a perfect reasoner and therefore is not somehow trying to adhere to norms. It simply is a perfect reasoner. And so I close by saying that I think one of the hardest tasks for the Stoics is to explain how, if our reasoning faculties are portions of the world's reason and portions of the best sort, as it were, so only sort of not the best, the second best sort. So the not perfect, not as the reason of the world, but the best sort that comes up among compounds other than the world as a whole. How then these epistemic norms or norms of assent fit into the picture? I think that is like truly hard task, but given that my aim for this paper is only to reconstruct the problem, that is good news for me, because that is the topic that they go on and on about all the time. So I think that means that they recognize that that is really a hard task to explain and account for these norms. Thank you.